The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney.
Kevin, each year we do 1 or 2 weeks back-to-back, depending on the number of questions and the time it takes to adequately answer them, to look at the curiosity of our listeners, the things that have been on their minds, the things that have lingered in the back of their brains and have had them say, well, what about this or what about that? What if this were to happen and then that were to happen, whether it's scenario-specific or economically theoretical or, you know, concerned with certain political outcomes? Our questions this year are across the board. Each of the categories that we've been interested in and remain interested in, some of them are economic, some of them are specifically financial, some of them are political, some of them are very geopolitical.
David, it's not just across the board, but what's fascinating to me is the response that we've had from around the world. We've got people who are calling in or writing in actually from Hong Kong, from Puerto Rico, Switzerland, other places like Singapore. People are asking questions not just in this nation, what's going to happen, but they're looking at this in a world context.
Kevin, I think one of the things that's most encouraging about doing these kinds of programs is that we are getting direct feedback from our listeners, and we have a better idea of who they are, a better idea of what's on their minds. And it's actually so encouraging to me, Kevin, because what we have is a snapshot of thinking people, a snapshot of people who are interested in the truth, a snapshot of people who are concerned about reality, and it's universal. As you mentioned, Kevin, I mean, we're not talking about, you know, two people in South Florida or one person in Great Britain. We're talking about dozens of people all over the world, every continent, not every country, but every continent around the world. And these are people who are trying to make heads and tails of what's happening in the world today and what they should be doing about it.
Yeah, it's not just a rah-rah shish-kumbah show for just telling people what they want to hear, like gold, 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 or stock, stock, stock. But actually, there's a lot of paradox that comes through these shows. I mean, you and I have had discussions where after the show, we're like, wow, I didn't think about that, which is exactly the reason for this show.
We're going to dive right into the questions in no particular order this year, just a question, and we'll explore the answer. What we would invite you to do is, if this happens to be your question and you want to explore the conversation in a more in-depth manner, give us a call.
Yeah.
Talk to us directly. We'd love to, or send us another email, and we'll continue to carry on the dialogue. We really enjoy that.
Let me go ahead and start with Hatim's question in Hong Kong. He says, "Dear David and Kevin, thanks for producing a consistently educational show. For almost 2 years of listening to you and imbibing on almost everything I could read or hear on gold, inflation, and deflation, I knew I had to do something to preserve my capital. So I got up the courage to buy a significant position in a popular ETF, a gold ETF. I'm embarrassed to admit that right after that, I sold out with a small loss based on investor sentiment indicating 98% of the participants bullish on gold, and based on a convincing and dire deflation scenario from some of the very prominent analysts out there. Then, after listening to your program consistently this year, I renewed my conviction, and I got right back in. Only recently, it occurs to me that I'm not the only schizophrenic investor out there. There's probably lots more likely. Then I read one of John Hathaway's comments from 2006, with gold then at $550, up 25%. He said that many are still on the sidelines, frozen in place, for fear that it's too late. That was then. He appears to have been right. My question is twofold. First, do you think that we're in the same position today, with many still on the sidelines, despite the lofty sentiment indicators? And second, what advice would you give on how to gird yourself or oneself against the temptation to sell core positions, given that your argument for the gold price is in the thousands? How do we fend off ourselves?
Kevin, I mean, there's a couple of different things to point out there. One is that last question is piercing.
M&A. How do we fend off ourselves?
Yeah, because as an investor, you have to embrace a certain knowledge of yourself and understanding of yourself, not in an idealized form. This is where you will do worse over time. In certain areas of life, you can pretend or fabricate a certain image of yourself and it works for you. In the world of investments, if you don't have an appreciation of who you are, truly who you are, you will be abused by the market at every turn.
And a humility. Right? You just don't want to be out there defending your position too long while you're going broke.
That's right. So let's look at both of those questions, Kevin. You know, many investors are still on the sidelines, as it's nearly impossible, Kevin, for many people to hold two opposite ideas in their heads at the same time. People are largely hoping for the best, and that means that they can't really consider or prepare for the worst. It's the issue of most investors either being bullish on the one hand or bearish, and their investment commitments being fully committed in one direction or the other.
Right.
So I think what we still see in the markets, Kevin, is that hope is a dominant theme amongst investors. They're looking with promise on the various bailout agendas, both in the U.S. and in Europe.
Maybe things will change. That's what they're thinking.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that the next wave into gold will not be on the basis of inflation or monetary concerns, but flight capital. And this is something that we've talked about in the office for years, is that there's many motivations to buy gold, many motivations to buy silver. One that both gold and silver share in common is that inflationary consequence that you're trying to guard against. Bad monetary policy impacting your own portfolio, and you're to hedge against that. That is where gold and silver share something in common. There's a distinction, though, particularly looking at gold, where you can see flight capital on the basis of geopolitical concerns. And this last week is just a classic case in point.
With Korea.
And what we saw was with the launch of the missiles from North Korea to South Korea, the stock markets of the world sold off. Silver, platinum, and palladium sold off. And gold went up.
Yeah.
What is that?
That fear response.
That is a fear response.
Yeah.
And I think as we see political and geopolitical themes become even more dominant, gold will take on a very different market profile. So as we transition into 2011, that profile will reflect fear and the capitulation of hope, which is still a hallmark of the current market. So in answer to the first part of that question, yes, there are many investors still on the sidelines because there are many investors still holding on to hope. And that will change, as will the complexion of the investor entering the gold market, not just focused on inflation, but with other dimensions as well.
Okay, so the second part of the question, how do we fend off ourselves? How do we not, in fear, sell off core positions that ultimately need to stay intact?
Yeah, that's a very, very valuable question. Leading into that was the reason that this particular investor sold a part of his gold holdings, and it was that sentiment indicators were telling him that there were too many people in gold or interested in gold, and the majority is always wrong. At least that's the healthy way of looking at it. Most people are doing the wrong thing at the wrong time. So even with something as legitimate as gold, if there's too many people interested, too many people involved, maybe it's telling you that it's time for a correction. That would have been the assumption that he was running on with that 98% bullish sentiment indicator. There's a couple of things there, Kevin, because first of all, the sentiment indicators are usually dealing with traders, not a broad cross-section of investors, but traders who think in terms of nanoseconds and not longer-term trends.
Right.
So what are you feeling right now about a particular asset? What you feel right now may be different than what you feel 2 seconds from now as a trader. So that's a part of the qualification in terms of the sentiment indicators. The other thing is that traders are not being asked about their commitments. They're being asked about their sentiments about a particular asset. So if, say, for instance, gold has a 20% run, it's pretty hard for a trader to argue against that trend. And he may say, even though he doesn't own the asset, he may say in light of the trend, in light of the momentum in that particular asset, that he's bullish.
Right.
So it's important to make the distinction that a sentiment indication is not the same thing as a commitment in the market. Now, if I knew that 98% of the population of the world was buying gold, then I would probably agree we're due for a correction. That trade is now, as they say, crowded. But that's not necessarily what a sentiment indicator says. Again, who are the people involved? It's the traders. And are they necessarily committed to that trade? No, they're not necessarily committed. They're being asked a question of how they feel in light of what's happening in the marketplace.
Well, and wouldn't you say Hatim used the correct term when he said core positions? There is a core position of gold that always stays intact, whether you're in a bull or a bear. Is that not right?
Yeah, and perhaps we can discuss that as we have in the past in the context of the perspective triangle.
Okay, well, let's move on to the next question then from Manuel.
The second part, or perhaps the third part, is fending off oneself. And really what you're talking about is maturing as an investor, you're developing a self-awareness, taking and practicing a third-person self-appraisal. This is something that Karen Horney talked a lot about in her book, Neurosis and Human Growth. And it's just the appreciation of who you are, not first person, here's how I'm feeling, but from a more objective position, as if you're observing yourself. And I think it's important as an investor makes a decision, if they can, after having made the decision, figure out why it is that they did make that decision. What was going on in their minds? Was it a surge of emotional energy? Was it a number of logical things that they put together? And finally, a surge of emotional energy. Why were they justifying having made that decision? What were the biases that they had leading up to that decision? Were the things that they were assuming that aren't necessarily the case, but they have to be committed to in order to make that decision? So again, it's basically unpacking all the baggage as to how you actually made the decision.
You know, and that third person analysis has seemed to me, for my own personal sake, to take in stress. It takes stress out of the decision. You can step back and go, I can breathe because I'm really not connected to this. I'm just observing. And it's an amazing way to be objective, as much objectivity as you can have.
Kevin, going back 15 years ago, I used to keep a journal of investment decisions that did not work out. When I lost money, I wanted to understand how I lost money and what I was thinking. What happened in the process leading up to the decision to commit capital to a particular idea? And why didn't it work? And I'd keep a journal, and it was just an ongoing journal. So this particular investment, I lost X percent, I lost X number of dollars. How did it happen? And it wasn't like I had to come to a conclusion immediately. It was an ongoing dialogue with myself. It may come to me 6 months from now. I didn't see that. I didn't realize that. I didn't know that. I didn't realize that I had educational deficiencies and would have seen this very differently had I been aware of this particular concept, this particular truth, this particular experience in a historical context. So it allowed me to really gain a tremendous amount of value out of a mistake that otherwise I could repeat again and again and again. So I think fending off oneself is a question of, I mean, there's other things, of course, developing a strong constitution or recognizing whether or not you have a strong enough constitution to be an investor,
right,
and be subject to the vagaries of the market, recognizing biases, regularly reevaluating your assumptions, being willing to be patient. These are all things that develop over a course of time, but I think one of the biggest things that for Hatim that I would hone in on is trying to remain objective and understand the broader context that you're investing in.
Well, and honestly, that's what this show is all about, continuing to educate so that a person can stay objective.
And that's really what we've tried to focus on in this program, is identifying primary trends. And if you have identified primary trends, then sticking with those primary trends. But those trends do change, which means the analysis never ends. You have to reevaluate all the time and realize when those trends begin to come undone. And so there is a constant work, and it's not enough to be convinced of a particular investment theme. You have to be unconvinced as well as convinced, because over a course of time, you will see those contextual issues change, and that particular investment theme simply go away.
Well, and speaking of challenging the thought process, Manuel from San Juan, Puerto Rico writes, I've been listening to your show for the past few months, and I've been very impressed with the level of analysis and your market insights. My question to you today is as follows. I understand the case for gold, and the reasoning makes perfect sense. However, in the post-QE2 environment, isn't it fair to say that all asset classes, equities, real estate, other commodities, etc., will benefit from the rising tide phenomenon caused by massive money printing? Why stay out of equities when our dollars are losing purchasing power on a seemingly daily basis? It seems to me that being all cash these days would be a dangerous thing. Is there still a case to be made for staying out of equities and real estate post-QE2?
Well, the first part of the question, Kevin, is dealing specifically with quantitative easing and where that liquidity flows. Mm. Some asset classes will rise with the tide of money and liquidity creation, but to varying degrees. And I say some because not all will rise. And the ones that do will be to varying degrees, not all equally. Gold is driven by various motivations of its investors, and these motivations include an inflationary thesis, but are not exhausted by that thesis alone. As we mentioned earlier, there's other reasons for it to move, not just the fact that money has been created. Now, there are reasons why, let's talk about real estate a bit, perhaps the case against real estate and equities post-QE2. QE2, as with the European bailouts, have targeted the financial community and the banking community specifically. And there is this continued theme of, quote-unquote, extending and pretending, in which bankers are trying to ignore the diminished value of assets in their balance sheet and hope for a return to normalcy. The problem, Kevin, is with the concept of normalcy that most in our financial circles have. And their sense of normalcy has been defined by the last 15 or 20 years, even 30 years, of credit expansion.
Which is a relatively short time frame in any historic perspective, but this one in particular is different than normal.
Well, one of the things that's different is the scale of credit creation. It's the greatest credit creation in recorded financial history. And so when you look at real estate and equities and see that you've had a pullback off of peak valuations, the question is, how do you go back to those peak valuations when something very structural is changing, and that is the nature of credit? Will we return to what credit was?
Those prices in real estate came from the availability of just too much credit.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So it's not that real estate or equities are a bad bet. It's a question of when you choose to enter those markets, off of what low level are you willing to commit capital? I would not be willing to commit capital today, because my view is that both in the equity arena and in the real estate arena, there has not been a full adjustment or a full appreciation to a change in the credit markets.
Well, how about equities? He asks about equities. What's your thought there?
One more thing on real estate, and it's just that what we will see is that certain properties will do very well. And we're talking about the cream of the crop. Select cities, select neighborhoods, select properties themselves. Don't expect appreciation from real estate for some time, because on a broad basis, it does have to do with the cost of capital. And I think we'll see the cost of capital rise dramatically over the next few years. Certainly beyond 2014, 15, and 16. And we'll talk about that in a bit, why that time frame is significant. But equities also need to adjust to a changing landscape. And a part of that changing landscape, Kevin, brings in the theme of geopolitical issues now in play. Protectionism, trade barriers, these are things that have diminished over the last 10 to 15 to 20 years and are now coming back into play as sovereign entities are choosing to protect their home turf and can't be thinking about world peace and sort of a broad global vision, because if they think in those terms, their local constituency groups will simply throw them out of office for not having paid enough attention to the problems directly under their noses. So what we're seeing is that trend towards deglobalization, a rise in trade barriers and protectionism, and I don't know that that's really been appreciated in the equities communities as a new and, I wouldn't say permanent, state of affairs, but something that is with us for the next 3 or 4 or 5 years.
Well, David, something you've brought out in the past, even in a high or hyperinflation, you know, equities outperform bonds, they outperform currency, of course, but they actually underperform the devaluation of the currency. So unlike gold, which actually keeps up with the buying power, equities may still go up in a high inflation, but they are still net losers in the buying power index.
And there's a specific question on that we'll address a little bit later in the program, where we'll talk about equities and how they perform in the context of a super hyperinflation. So, Kevin, lastly, on Manuel's question, there is an issue with equities which has to be taken into consideration. We're assuming that there is an inflationary trend as a result of money creation, quantitative easing, monetization, etc., and that there is ultimately an impact into the commodity sphere as a result. If that's correct, then you have a tax in the form of higher commodity prices that flow through to many of your publicly traded companies. And so the profitability, the earnings, take a significant hit.
The resources are costing those companies more money, thus that cuts into their profitability.
Exactly. So they're at the end of an inflationary whip at a very basic level. You can't pass along all of those increased costs instantaneously. There's usually a lag time. So frankly, Kevin, you've got companies that would be affected in two ways. One is that rising commodity costs impact the consumer. The consumer does not necessarily have more money to spend in the context of quantitative easing, because as we mentioned earlier, the focus of QE2, as with QE1, as with the bailouts in Europe, have been into the financial sector. And QE1, as you'll note, that money never made its way into the economy. There was never an inflationary benefit in terms of wage increases and access to that money or liquidity by the man in the street. So there can be an inflationary impact in terms of assets or commodities without there being an increase in availability of capital at the street level. So that's a part of it, is you don't necessarily have more money to spend. Meanwhile, you may have those items going up in cost, which we've seen. I mean, this year is a classic case in point. How many companies, whether it's Procter & Gamble, whether it's Heinz, whether it is Kraft Foods, whether it is General Mills, all jumping their prices. And as we noted earlier this year in a program talking about inflation, sort of the subtle form of inflation, the size of the boxes are shrinking.
Your cereal box was getting smaller, Dave. Sorry.
That's right.
Price was the same, though.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So this inflationary trend does not have to equal greater profits for companies. It does not have to equal an increase in the share price of those profits. That's the final issue, is that you have an adjustment which can take place, where company chiefs increase the cost of a particular product in the marketplace, but it's usually done on a delayed basis. So they actually have to absorb that increase in commodity cost for a certain period of time.
So your short answer is not yet for equities.
Correct.
Yeah. Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com. Okay, moving on to the question from Mark. He said, I listen very faithfully to your show every week, namely the last month and a half or so, as I learn so much. My question is whether precious metals might go beyond the 1-to-1 Dow gold ratio that has been mentioned often on your show, and whether a better indicator of precious metal prices might be the Fed's low Fed funds rate and additional quantitative easing, as you implied in your conversation with the Aiden sisters. Thanks so much for all you do. What would you respond to Mark? Are we going to go beyond the 1-to-1 ratio, the Dow gold ratio, Dave?
I don't know that I would use as a better indicator of the direction of the metals prices or that relative relationship. I don't know that I would rely on the Fed funds rate or on quantitative easing. Quantitative easing, we've seen one instance, now we've seen a second. That doesn't mean that we'll be in a perpetual state of quantitative easing. In fact, looking on the other side of the G20 meeting in Seoul, South Korea, we had the Fed and Obama soundly reprimanded by the whole world. This was a significant event. The G20 meeting in Seoul may mark a significant turning point in our monetary history, as the world said, no, you may not do that. We know exactly what you're doing with QE2. It is destroying the value of your currency. We do not approve, and we will let you know how much we disapprove the next time you try to issue bonds.
It's a little bit like denying rigged dice. I mean, the dice were rigged in our favor, and they're basically saying, uh-uh, no more. We're not going to let you play with that pair.
Exactly. So quantitative easing I wouldn't use as a gauge. The Fed funds rate can be kept artificially low for a long, long period of time. That's the end of the yield curve where the Fed is in control. They can determine artificially by decree what that rate is, but as you move further out on the interest rate yield curve, that's where you begin to see a greater impact in terms of a market vote. As you move to the 2, the 5, the 10, the 15, the 20, the 30-year maturities, that's where you begin to see wider swings on the basis of market sentiment and the market vote.
Okay, so those are the things we're not going to look at.
And I would still come back to that and say that even with the amount of money being created today, although it does have a distorting effect effect in certain sectors, that the one-to-one ratio is a good guide.
It's at least a good time to take note, right? I mean, if you don't react with all of, obviously, a person shouldn't react with all of their gold. They should always have a third in gold. But as far as the money that they're trying to actually take a profit on, one-to-one ratio has historically been a very solid number, has it not?
It has. Let me just reiterate something there, because it is not as if looking at the Dow gold ratio is for us, I guess we've misnamed it an exit strategy. It is a reduction strategy.
Right.
And this is more or less what I would have in mind. When you look at the Dow gold ratio and are concerned about the potential of hyperinflation, one of the things that you might ask is, why would I sell any of my gold?
Sure.
And move into a currency where I could absolutely have my head handed to me,
yeah,
lose value instantly by coming out of gold and into a worthless currency. Well, I think the first point is that you would not be moving out of gold into a worthless currency or a devaluing currency. You would only be moving out of gold and into what we would call a productive asset,
which is maybe an equity at this point.
It could be an equity.
Yeah.
It could be land that has lease potential, you know, whether it is farmland where you're leasing out the rights to farm on it, whether it is a multifamily real estate complex where it has cash flow, existing cash flow on the basis of people who are there and a fairly stable base of people who've been there for some time and intend to be there. This is what I'm talking about, and just to illustrate what a productive asset would look like. But let's go back to the idea of it being a reduction and not an exit strategy.
Okay.
As a reduction strategy, our suggestion has been and will continue to be that at 3-to-1, the Dow gold ratio of 3-to-1, that you're eliminating a third of your total metals position.
Okay.
And moving to productive assets. At a 2-to-1 ratio, this is a critical distinction. You are eliminating a third of your remaining gold and silver portfolio.
Okay.
And then, Kevin, finally, at a 1-to-1 ratio, you are reducing by one-third of your remaining gold and silver portfolio, which in the end, what you've done is made a substantial and disciplined reduction while still maintaining a healthy allocation to the metal.
Sure, keeping in mind, if it's going to 1-to-1 ratio, it's probably a very, very high percentage of a portfolio. I mean, let's face it, if that happens, some of our clients may have 70, 75, 80% of their total assets in gold.
Yep.
This seems like a good reduction.
Well, and what's confusing is we're saying reduce by a third, and a third, which would assume that you're completely out.
Yeah.
And I'm saying, no. You eliminate a third off the top. If gold appreciates from there, it could double from there. I'm suggesting that whatever it does from there, you're only eliminating a third of what remains.
Sure.
And then the next reduction at a 1-to-1 is a third of what remains.
But you're never getting out of the boat.
Yeah. Correct. Because the critical thing is, if you do find yourself in a super or hyperinflationary scenario, yes, you have reallocated into productive assets, not a worthless currency, but plant, infrastructure, real assets with a tangible or book value, or that have a positive cash flow and are paying you to own them. But you still have a solid position in the metals. And in the event of hyperinflation, you are still very, very well protected and stand to benefit significantly, substantially, from the diminishment of value in the home currency by having not been in it.
Well, that's such an important concept. Well, moving to the next question. This one, David, concerns Russell Napier's views. We've interviewed Russell Napier a number of times, and this is a question asked by Jeff in Indiana. He said, I'm very confused about the various interviews that I've heard on this guy. He's talking about Russell Napier. In one segment late in 2009, he was calling for the S&P getting to 400 as a target. Then, in spring 2010, he had a pretty favorable view of equities in general, particularly among emerging markets. Since markets tend to move in concert these days, something doesn't jive with the above two predictions. Hoping you can clarify. Thanks, Jeff.
You know, Jeff, this would go back to a similar conversation that we had with the Aidens a number of weeks ago, in which I tried to ask them questions about a variety of asset classes under two different sets of circumstances. What is your short-term view? what's going to happen in the next 3 to 6 to 12 months, and what's your long-term view, your 3, 5, maybe even 10-year projection. And I think that's really what you're looking at, Jeff, with this particular issue in the Napier interviews. You've got the long view, which is that we're going to see the S&P at 400. The significant, significant reduction from current values.
And I don't think Napier's changed his tune on that at all.
No, he hasn't. He still looks at 2014 to 2016 as an end game for the equity markets. And interestingly, he ties in the theme of there being a fiscal and monetary catastrophe at the sovereign level. So he sees a debt crisis unfolding, which is what ultimately triggers a final collapse in the stock market. Well, what we have right now in the short view, coming back to sort of, you know, the next 3 to 6 to 12 months, maybe in the next 2 years, is the intervention attempts by the Fed, by the Treasury here in the U.S., and by the similar authorities globally. And we're seeing those interventions play out. Will they work? Will they not work? There's a certain time lag, if you will, between an announcement and then the realization that, no, it won't work.
Right.
I'm reminded, for instance, of the Russian bond default. We remember 1998, largely because long-term capital management failed, and it almost took our whole financial system with it. Okay. But what happened in triggering the collapse of long-term capital management was a default in the Russian bond market. Well, very interestingly, those bonds that they defaulted on in 98 had been originally repackaged and restructured in 1994. So you were talking about a 4-year fuse that burned, and then finally it blew up.
This is why keeping your journal is probably so important. How would those guys have known in 1994 what would have happened to LTCM later?
Well, exactly. So the first bond restructuring happens in 1994, and then you end up, I mean, everyone assumes, okay, well, we've restructured the debt, everything's fine, we've got the worst behind us. And it's only 4 years later that you have the same catastrophe on a much larger scale. And instead of a restructuring, it's an outright default. This time, the second shoe drops. And I think that's the kind of thing that we're seeing right now, Kevin. We're trying to restructure liabilities. We had TARP and TALF and all these things which were done in 2008, which were done on 2- and 3-year paper, which puts the deadline to restructure again in 2011 here in the U.S. on that particular tranche of paper, which was intended to sort of be the thumb in the dike and keep there from being a larger catastrophe. We now have to readdress the issue in 2011, and what's very popular amongst our fiscal and monetary authorities is taking these things in small little increments.
Putting a little Band-Aid on a big wound is really what they're doing.
Exactly. Yeah. So this was a 3-year Band-Aid. Are they going to do anything different? Are they going to try to restructure TARP and TALF and any of those types of bailout programs with the next 20 and 30 years in mind?
Right.
No, because the cost of capital, if you're financing 20 and 30 year paper, is so much more expensive.
Well, you've said, Dave, 70% of our debt comes due in the next 5 years. So we're talking a 5-year period of time. They're 30 year or 20 year periods of time. They can't possibly think that far anymore.
And this is what really brings me back to the importance of Napier's views and being able to toggle back and forth as a listener between, okay, now what is he talking about here? Is he talking about immediately in front of us,
right,
which he's been spot on. We've seen a recovery in the stock market from the lows of 666 on the S&P, and lo and behold, it's an impressive number today.
I even squirmed when he said that, David. I was like, what is he talking about? There's going to be a market for treasuries at negative interest rates. But he was like, no, I think right now there's going to be a market for treasuries.
At
negative interest rates.
There has been. But one of the things that he's also anticipating is the fuse burn between now and 2014.
Yeah.
And that fuse that's burning is the restructured, repackaged debt obligations, which fixed the liquidity issue of 2008, but never solved the solvency issue, which was actually the underlying and structural issue.
Right.
We still have to deal with a solvency crisis, and that still is in front of us. Is it 2011?
Right.
12? 13? 14? Now we're back into that range where he's assuming the fuse is done, we see something blow, and that causes a major decline in the S&P and the Dow across the board.
Well, you know, David, we've talked about before, if you have a slow leak on a bike or a car, you can pump it up and you can actually hide the problem for a period of time. But there's still the ka-thunk, 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 ka-thunk coming down the road because you haven't fixed the hole.
Right. Well, what he's anticipating, Kevin, is the second shoe needing to drop.
Yeah.
And I would guess that that's when the plunge protection team is out of options. They can't finance things. They don't have access to easy capital. The Fed has run out of options themselves. And now the plunge protection team can't protect the stock market because they don't have access to cheap capital anymore.
Well, David, I'm looking forward to getting to more questions next week. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. You can find us on the Internet there, or you can give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.